history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories out there that need to be told, and we're not going to hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to whatever may come of that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Barstow, California, home for more than four decades, to Bob Izumi, who's got a story that in some ways is almost hard to believe. The life experiences that you've had, the places you've been, the things you've done for our country. We're going to hear about decades and decades of service to our country in one way or another in different branches of service, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines. But tell me about growing up in Southern California. Big family. You got a lot brothers and sisters.
I was a kind of a loner from the rest of my brothers. I never was close to any of my brothers, except for, I think, Herbie. He never was in the service, but he was an engineer for Douglas. Frank, he was MIS. And my brother George, he was a baker. And my brother Tom, I don't know what he did. And my brother Roy was an electronics man. They're all in the Army. The only other one was Jack. He went in, and then the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. He had to stay in for the rest of the duration.
Oh, wow. So this is Los Angeles in the 1930s, and you're growing up in a Japanese-American family, and you weren't alone. The Japanese-American culture in L.A. at that time was very rich and very prolific.
But I didn't go to any of the Japanese school to learn the language.
I've heard some stories about that you've had people try to speak Japanese to you in recent years when they honor you.
I couldn't do it.
Well, what was your childhood like as far as school and activities and maybe even the dreams or ambitions that you had growing up?
Yeah, junior high school, I didn't, still was just about two of us that were all good friends. That's where, you know who Norma Jean Baker is?
I think a lot of listeners will recognize that name as the future Marilyn Monroe. Oh, you got a picture right above me of Marilyn Monroe, and it's autographed by her.
Yes.
And she was your classmate?
Yes, sir.
In junior high?
Yes, Emerson Junior High School, and she went to University High School there. And I think she quit school in the 10th grade, and she kind of blossomed out after that.
Did you have any indication of future stardom for her?
No, she was very homely.
Did you ever throw spit wads at her or anything?
Oh, no. Never did, no.
Well, some people, depending on their priorities, they might say, hey, did you know that Marilyn Monroe went to school with Bob Izumi because of all the things that you've done since then? Tell me what you remember about December 7th, 1941.
December 7th, I was roller skating. I'll never forget it because I was roller skating with a guy named Chuck Fine down Santa Monica Boulevard. And then it came through the radio and everybody stopped and listened. Then I roller skated home after that. I asked my dad, did you hear the news? He says, yeah, I know. I heard the news. And then my dad wouldn't talk too much about Japan or things like that. But he was a very honorable man to me. He was a man that my brothers didn't understand him, but I did. I would sit down next to him, and I can see in his face that what he wanted me to do. I didn't speak Japanese to him. I just knew what he wanted. The rest of the brothers, my dad would take me into town, fill up the gas tank and everything, and it was kind of odd because my dad liked me, and, well, he liked all the rest of the sons, but I think I was more close to my dad. I have a rocking chair. It was made way back in 18-something.
Wow.
And he took it all the way into Manzanar and brought it back. And when he passed away, they were going to break it up. So I brought it and I redone the whole chair.
Wow. What a treasure. And so much that chair has been through and survived through. As you talk about that relationship with your dad and on December 7th, and I should point out you already had a brother in the military at
that
point.
Yes, Jack was in the military.
Did it start to hit you that being a Japanese-American on the West Coast was going to be an issue?
I didn't think anything about it because I was little. And even in camp, I didn't. I thought it was a thrill being in camp because those towers and had a machine gun. I think they had a water-cooled machine gun. I didn't know what a water-cooled machine gun was until I got in the service.
Sure. But you thought camp was a thrill. I don't know if that's going to register for some people listening, because if they know the history, they know 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast were forced out of their homes and sent elsewhere. And for you and your family, it was Manzanar, right, inland, but not too far away. But how did you handle that news at the time, that everything you've ever known, your home, your neighborhood, your friends, your school, you're not allowed to be there anymore?
I didn't think nothing about it. See? The older people helped. I realize that now, but as I was a little one, I thought it was a thrill seeing a Caucasian in uniform with their rifles, and I'll never forget it. We had to take a stamp and a little tag, and they stamped me C4. You know what C4 means?
Oh, 4C. Enemy 4C. Alien. Yeah.
Right. They put me an alien. Most people don't know that. They tore up all of our birth certificates.
They tore them up.
Yep. And we were aliens. I didn't think nothing about it.
You're born in this country, but now you're an enemy of this country. Held hostage behind barbed wire. What about, a big family like that, I'm sure you guys had a lot of stuff. Every kid probably had.
My mom put everything into, we had a cellar. But I found out later on in the years that they looted that cellar and they took everything out.
So while you guys were in the internment camp, someone went and they found all your stuff in the cellar. So you, probably everybody in your family had
something in this.
Yeah.
It's all gone.
What about life in the camp? How'd you pass the time? What kinds of things did you do?
Well, there was three of us. Like I said, I didn't really fool around with other Japanese-American kids, except for the two. We snuck under the barbed wire. We watched the spotlights. We knew when the spotlights passed us, and we dug a hole under the barbed wire and went up where the stream came down. We made a pool and jumped in there and cleaned up, and I wish I would. I'd go up there and see if it's still there. I don't know.
I wonder.
Yeah.
But then you still had to get back in the camp without getting caught, right?
Right. We knew when the spotlights were.
What do you think would have happened to you if you got caught?
Well, there was an incident about that. It was a man that did the same thing. He walked toward the mountain, and he was an old fella. He couldn't have never get up that mountain without no ropes or anything, but they said he was a spy and everything. That's what I heard. So I guess the military police went up to the mountain, couldn't find him, but where he was, they found him the following, after the winter was, they found him sitting on the rock. He was froze.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know you said it was a thrill, but was there anything about being in the camp that seemed unfortunate to you or a challenge to you?
It didn't hit me until I got out of the service and I had to go do my own thing. The reason I got out is a teacher named Helen Ely from Iowa said, "Bob," he says, "do you want to get out of here and finish high school in Des Moines, Iowa?" I said, I would do that if you get the okay. So she wrote back to Washington, D.C. and if I had any bad marks against me. But there was no mark against me because I was just a youngster. So the government okayed it. Then I went back to Iowa. My brother Roy and I got on the bus and went to Iowa. Roy went to some other town, but I went to Okeechobee Lake to be a person you walk into a hotel, like a bellhop or something.
A bellman or something,
yeah. And I was that really nice. Anyway, so the little boy come up to me, and he says, "How come you don't have buck teeth?" And I said, "What do you mean?" So he got in his back pocket and had a comic book with the Japanese with the buck teeth with a rising sun flag.
Oh, man.
And he says, "How come you're here?" I said, "I'm an American. I'm here because I have to finish my high school." And he just left. But I'll never forget the way he said that.
Yeah, I can see why that would stick with you. And a lot of people probably haven't heard a story like that. They've heard about neighboring families maybe who took care of a Japanese family's land or possessions.
Right.
But so this was a school teacher in Iowa?
She volunteered from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to come into Manzanar to teach school. And then there's a fellow named Mr. Greeley. He was a professor from USC, but he was blind. And the guys in the classes, let's bet who can sneak out. But I guess when a blind people knows each step or can hear what's going on,
they think they can get away with sneaking out of class because he's not going to see
them. So they bet me that I said, "I'll bet you I can get out." So that day, took my shoes off, and I start walking out. He says, "Where are you going, Bob Izumi?" He did say that.
How did he know it was you?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
Boy, talk about having a sixth sense.
Yeah, he was good, Mr. Greeley. There was quite a few teachers I admire, and I wish Helen was the most one.
You mentioned, getting into the service. Now, a lot of people, they think, well, if my country is holding me and all my family members captive behind barbed wire, The last thing I want to do is go put on the uniform and fight for that very country that's holding my family captive. How did that happen for you? How did you become part of the U.S. Armed Forces?
Well, my brother Jack was in the service, so I said, well, I'll go in. As soon as I finished high school, I went to the Army recruiting Fort Des Moines, Iowa, and joined the service in September 1944. Then from there, I went down to Camp Landing, Florida.
So how long until they put you in the Gopher Broke unit, the 442nd?
From September 44 till November 44. So I didn't stay too long with them. November 44, I transferred into the 101st Airborne Division, and I was in Reims in France that 44. You had camps over there named after cigarettes, Chesterfield, Marlboro, Philip Morris, and I stayed there, and I met Pee Wee Martin.
I want to hear about all that, but I don't want to miss anything here. So as soon as you go into the Army, they say, okay, you're Japanese-American. You're going with all the rest of the Japanese-Americans in the 442nd. Did that strike you as different or odd? I mean, in today's world, that segregation idea, I think, would make people's heads spin.
I didn't think nothing about it because when I joined the 442nd, they were all Japanese with black hair. So I didn't think nothing bad about it. It was a fellow from New York we called Hoppa. Hoppa means half and half. I got kind of mad at one of the guys because they were picking on him because he was half and half.
He was half Japanese and half
white, or Caucasian. So anyway, they kind of picked on him and everything. And finally, Lieutenant Brown knew what was going on. They discharged him. They gave him a discharge, so he got out. And that's the only incident I know of that, I mean, prejudice type.
Mm-hmm. Not spending a whole lot of time in that Gopher Broke unit. I'm sure you still take pride in the accomplishments of
yes,
the
sir.
442. What do you think people today need to know about that unit and the things that they did and the price that they paid?
Well, we were a close-knitted outfit. We never did go away. If somebody got wounded, we'd take care of them. It was a very close-knitted unit. We were the most decorated unit in the United States Army. I had a very good friend named Jimmy Eno. He got 18 bullet holes in his hips. They shot him. Then I saw him again when the war was over. He lived in Littleton, Colorado, and I saw him. He became a priest.
How about that?
Yeah.
Well, was there a moment for you that was the indoctrination or the baptism? When did you first realize how dangerous a situation you were in?
Oh, well, the dangerous situation is I saw this pilot come down, and I was, I don't know, a couple thousand feet behind him, came down and crash-landed. And Mac, the medic, saw him come down. The OP told the medic to go out there, and the pilot crawled out of the ship. And it caught on fire. And the pilot put this parachute over him because the Germans were on the left-hand side and the pilot was on this side and they were shooting at him. So he covered his body with his parachute because it was white and he couldn't see him. So this Mac got him out of there and I helped him with, put him in the Jeep, took him into town. And after that, I didn't see him until 60-some years later, which I didn't know.
Well, yeah, this is an incredible story, and I know there's others to tell, but we might as well hear the rest of this now. So this is a gentleman just recently passed away by the name of Harry Krieg, P-47 pilot, flew tons of missions over there, and you helped rescue him during World War II. But just here in the last few years, you're going to a dinner here in the Barstow area that they do every year, right? Veterans dinner?
Yes.
Tell me what happened, how you found out who this guy was. And
well, I didn't know who he was until he tapped me on the shoulder, and I swung around like that, and I was going to hit him, and he backed off, and he was a colonel in the Air Force, retired. We talked when the newspaper heard about it, and they interviewed us. And I saw him a couple of times and talking, but never met his son until just after he passed away.
But, I mean, it's 60-something years after the war, and a guy taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, you're the one who came and rescued me.
Well, I didn't rescue him. I helped rescue him.
But still, I mean, what are the odds of that? 16 million Americans in uniform, and he happens to run into you in this fairly remote part of California?
Yes, it's 1,000. I don't know. I can't explain. Well, I'll give you another instance. As we were marching out in January 45, a little girl, I got a picture of a little girl come up, grabbed me and gave me a hug, and I said, okay. I pushed her away. 60-something years later, this lady came up and hugged me and kissed me here three times. That's the Belgium. And I pushed her. I didn't mean to push her away, but I pushed her away. And she said, don't you remember me? I said, no. I said, I don't remember you. She says, do you remember a little girl giving you a hug when you come out of the forest? I said, yes. She said, that's me.
Wow.
And then each year I would thought, she's in a home now, but I would go there each year, and she would bring me a great big plant of poinsettias.
Well, and the reason these people can be sure it was you is because you're the only Japanese-American in the 101st Airborne. That's how they know if that paratrooper was Japanese-American, and you're the only one. But before you got into the 101st, and I want to hear that story, how you got into the 101st, did you see any action with the 442? Were you involved in any engagements?
At the end, I was an anti-aircraft man.
Uh-huh.
And not too much, just lobbing in there. I didn't see too much with the 442nd.
And how does a guy from the 442nd, which is made up of Japanese Americans because they're not letting them do anything else other than be interpreters or work with language in the military intelligence service, how does a Japanese American soldier of the 442 get into the 101st Airborne?
Well, I just volunteered for it, and later on I found out Andy, he's passed on. Andy, he went through jump school a week before I did, and he jumped in Kwajalein for that island.
Uh-huh.
And there was quite a few MIS in Merlin Marauders. Ben Kuroki, Sergeant Ben Kuroki, was tail gunner in the Air Force. So I told my commanding officer, there is Japanese Americans in the other services. There were quite a few in the Navy also, but I didn't know that. I volunteered for the paratroopers, and I didn't have no backlog, like being, oh, you're a dirty chap or something, you can't do that. I didn't have nothing like that. Even in my regiment, Pee Wee Martin, he was my mentor. I went through jump school, and it was good, and Fort Benning, I would do it again. The guys were just a big family. It was really close. We were more closer in the 506G company than I was in the 442nd.
Really?
Yes, really close. I'd do it again.
I believe it, and I know it was another company from your regiment, Easy Company, that became known as the Band of Brothers, but sounds pretty applicable to your unit, too. Time to take our first break now, but we'll hear about Bob Izumi's time with the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment when we come back. We'll also follow him to Korea and Vietnam, and in between, his work with test pilots, some famous names there, and even a couple UFO stories. Find photos of Bob then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.